Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Charlene Aiken, bar number 35396, and I represent the appellant respondent, Timothy Moore, in this case. There are three issues I'd like to discuss with you today. The first is that the prenuptial agreement here was valid and enforceable, and the second is that husband's separate property remained separate even though it had to pass through a joint account for one business day. And the third being that his separate property funds of $76,561, which was used for marital expenses, was omitted from the property spreadsheet and he should be reimbursed. One important fact before I move on, the parties here were Canadian citizens who were moving assets from a Canadian monetary system to a U.S. monetary system. The prenuptial agreement in this case is valid and enforceable, and there is a trial court finding, made a factual finding, excuse me, that the prenuptial agreement was valid, as well as the party stipulating to the prenuptial agreement being valid. Because we have a valid prenuptial agreement, this takes property outside of Colorado law 1410.113, and it's also binding as to the disposition of property and debt.
Well, as I read the agreement, does not contain the word debt. Do you agree?
That is correct, Your Honor. And
why shouldn't then the Colorado statutes be the default choice for debt?
I believe, Your Honor, that we have to look at how the trial court treated debt, and the trial court did treat debt under the agreement, page 2, section A, family assets. There's a reasonable interpretation under that definition that it includes debt which was incurred for marital expenses, and you are correct that the premarital agreement is silent as to debt, but the debt should be included into the family assets.
Well, are you aware of any case in this context or otherwise that treats debt as an asset?
Case law?
Yeah. Or IRS definition or anything?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Moving on, the agreement also discussed separate property, and that was defined on page 5, subsection 7, which basically says that all property which is not a family asset will be separate property. And it's further defined in paragraph 8, which also says that separate property can be retained even if it's acquired during the term of the marriage. And what's relevant here is that separate property that is acquired by a gift or inheritance is defined in subparagraph 9 and states that that is separate property and any income derived therefrom is separate property, with some exceptions if that property is acquired to be a family asset. Agreement also requires an equal division of the property, and that's found in subsection 6, page 5, under ownership of property, which, as you know, differs from Colorado law, which requires an equitable division of the property. And here, the trial court did 264,321 as marital assets, and this was erroneously deducted from husband's share of the marital estate.
That's the stock, right?
That's the PCL stock. That's the PCL stock. That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. Help me understand. And maybe there are other possibilities, but it would seem to me that the court could treat that as a marital property in Colorado only if it was traced to marital assets, which would seem to be a factual determination based on the expert testimony, or because the funds went through this joint account for a very brief period before the stock was purchased. Can you explain to me how exactly the trial court concluded that the PCL stock was marital property?
The the trial court made a legal conclusion based on this paragraph 3, subsection 2, and construing that paragraph said that the PCL stock was marital assets. We believe this was an erroneous legal conclusion. If you construe subsection 2 with the rest of the paragraph under ownership of property, the PCL stock does not, it was not altered, the property character was not altered. Here, the PCL stock was proceeds of the sale of stock, and it had remained separate even though it had passed through that joint account. Let's look at where the PCL stock came from.
Okay, Brian, I'm still not losing, I'm not following it. Did the court find the PCL stock marital because the money used to buy it went through this joint account?
That is correct. The court found that it had, well, I think the court found that it just passed through the joint account, and because it was a joint account versus a separate account, it changed it in character from separate to marital.
Okay,
the trial court never found, sorry, that the PCL stock was a marital asset or was marital property.
The court didn't find that it had something to do with the employment relationship or the that was the character of the benefit that derived from?
The court did go into that section of the premarital agreement and did discuss the employment income and bonuses, and we believe that the trial court was erroneous in that respect because the PCL stock and the actual money, the deposits that were transferred into this joint account, was not employment income. Husband testified that he did not use either his long-term bonuses or his yearly bonuses to purchase PCL stock. He simply used his inheritance that he received and also the dividends that was reinvested into the PCL stock.
Was there conflicting evidence to the contrary?
No, I don't think there was conflicting evidence. Because the trial court had found that the PCL stock was purchased with separate funds, which was the father's inheritance. So the paragraph 4 that the trial court applied doesn't even apply here because this was not husband's employment income. It would be the same as if husband had invested in IBM stock with his inheritance and separate funds.
Well, the trial court never made a finding that part of the stock had been purchased with his employment, proceeds of his employment?
The trial court, I believe, mixed up the bonuses and...
Just tell me what the trial court found first, please.
The trial court found that his stock was purchased with his bonuses, but this was an erroneous...
Some of it or all of it?
Some of it was purchased with his bonuses.
Okay, so that's one, that would be one basis on which to uphold the trial court's judgment.
If it was a correct finding, but it's an erroneous finding based on the facts.
Okay, but you said the trial court also found that some of the stock was purchased with inheritance.
Correct. The trial court did find that the PCL stock was purchased with husband's inheritance.
Did the trial court prorate how much of the $260,000 came from?
The trial court basically took the deposits that were put into the joint account. There was one deposit, and that was the sale of the proceeds from the PCL stock because husband had left PCL, so he had to sell his stock. So the trial court did separate the two and just use that one deposit that was put into the account to put it over into the marital.
And does that cover the whole $260,000?
Yes.
Okay, and the money was only in there for a day?
Yes.
Where did it go after that?
Back into a separate account in the U.S. in Colorado.
Okay, so the PCL stock was bought and liquidated before the money went through the joint account?
Correct. It was the proceeds of the sale of the PCL stock after he left his employment, moving to Colorado, and then transferring that $264 from a Canadian separate account to the joint account in Colorado, and then back out to the separate account. And it was over the July 4th holiday, so it was July 3rd to July 5th.
Was there any testimony in the record that that his intent or his former wife's understanding was that laundering the money through that account made it a joint asset?
Actually, the wife had testified that she did not even know that husband had transferred this money to the joint account. And also what's relevant here that I should point out is let's look at wife's separate property. There was also a $4,000 proceeds of wife's separate property. She had some land with her brothers and sisters, and that was the second deposit. That was also transferred on the same day, same transaction, same account, went through the joint account back into the separate account, and the trial court found her separate property of $4,000, trial court found it as separate property, and it wasn't even listed on the property division spreadsheet.
Okay, so but his testimony that putting the $260,000 through this joint account for 24 hours was simply a matter of convenience is uncontroverted.
Exactly. It was a matter of convenience and efficiency to move the money from a Canadian account to a U.S. account. And I'd also like to point out that wife had an inheritance of $24,932, and this also passed through that same account a couple years later, and the trial court treated this as separate property, and it was also never listed on the spreadsheet.
Pardon me, counsel. I want to make sure I don't get confused here.
Okay.
Does your argument now mean that the passing through of the account wasn't the most important thing in the trial court's determination on husband's stock proceeds, but rather perhaps the notion that it was bought with his bonuses was the most important determinant of husband's proceeds?
Well, it was not bought with his bonuses.
I understand you're saying okay. That, but as Judge Ramon pointed out, if the record supported that, would that be a basis to award that to wife?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that would. I think the trial court made inconsistent findings here. I think that she mixed up that, first of all, that it somehow was purchased with bonuses, but then also making a finding that it was found to be purchased with husband's separate inheritance. She did rely on that paragraph, which talks about joint ownership of property, to say that it passed through that count, and in her opinion, that it had changed in character from separate to marital. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
I think so.
Okay. And moving on very briefly, the last issue I'd like to discuss is that husband had used $76,561 of separate funds to pay for marital expenses. The permanent orders expanded over a period of months. They had some time in April, and then they continued it in August. And in May of that year, the trial court had ordered husband to use his separate funds to pay marital expenses until the August 07 permanent orders. He understood that those marital expenses that were paid from his separate property would be allocated at permanent orders.
Well, what does his understanding have to do with it? I mean, I appreciate what happened. I apologize, that sounded kind of sarcastic. I mean, okay, unless the judge promised him that it would be somehow divided,
right,
or unless you can point to something in the prenup that supports his position, what does his understanding have to do with it?
Well, I think because he testified at the August 07 orders about the $76,000 that he had spent and what it was spent for marital expenses. And there's also nothing in the prenup that prevented him from getting reimbursement for these marital expenses, and also nothing in the agreement that required him to use his separate property to fulfill this obligation.
Well, let me quarrel with you on that. I mean, why isn't at least part of the $76,000 within the ambit of paragraph 5A, which talks about him supporting the wife?
Him supporting the wife, but it does not say in that paragraph that he must support the wife with his separate property funds.
Well, it says he has to do it with his income.
He has to do it with his income, and here they're just simply was no more marital assets to support the wife, but there's nothing in that paragraph that says he has to go from his separate property or that she has to take from her separate property, and when hers is
okay,
gone.
Are you saying that during this period of time, either he had no income or his income was exhausted, and that's why he had to dip into his separate property?
That's correct. There was absolutely no marital assets left because the home had the marital home.
You didn't answer my question. His income. He was,
his income.
Was he still employed?
No, he was not employed, and if he, okay. He was consulting and earning minimal income.
Okay, so he essentially had no income that would be within the ambit of this paragraph, and therefore the only alternative was separate property, which you would say he was not obligated to do under the prenup.
That is correct, okay. Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thanks. And I see that I'm out of time. I just ask that this court reverse the permanent orders on division of marital and separate property and determine it in accordance with the prenup. And this is all detailed on Appendix A to our reply brief.
Is it your position that to the extent, if at all, we agree with you, we should do that at the appellate level, or we should, if we agree with your arguments, remand with direction and give the trial court instructions consistent with your arguments?
I would actually love if you guys would do it at the appellate level, but if that is not possible, then a remand with very specific directions on the numbers and what categories they're supposed to go in.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Frank McGuane. I represent the appellee. She would have liked to have been here, but because of health reasons, she was unable to do so. We thought up until this morning that she might even be able to be here. I don't feel any need or desire to regurgitate what I had in my brief. I think I've really covered our points. There are a few comments I'd like to make. I think essentially what I'd like to emphasize is the fact that I think what this really comes down to is the issue of whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in entering the final orders that it entered. There was, if the court is familiar with the record, conflicting evidence on almost everything of any significance in the case. First of all, I was not the trial attorney, so I'm just kind of learning this by going back and reading all this stuff, but it was a bitterly contested, hard-fought case. As Judge Arkin found at one point, the attorney fees were approaching $500,000 altogether. So for that reason alone, I think there's reason for this court to give serious consideration to trying to find a way to affirm the trial court and end this long ongoing battle. The biggest challenge, Your Honors, in interpreting this prenuptial agreement, and there's no disagreement about the validity of the agreement, but this agreement used a term called family assets. Now, the appellant in the briefs and in the argument treats family assets and marital assets or marital property as synonymous terms, and I would respectfully submit that that's a huge error, that we have a valid agreement here, that the parties agree is valid, and so I think the appropriate approach here is to try, and I think the trial court did this as best it could, to interpret this agreement to the fullest extent possible. Now, there really are significant differences between the term family assets as defined in this agreement and the term marital property. The agreement says that the home that was used for the family was going to be a family asset, irrespective of where the money came from. It said that the property used by the family, including boats and furniture and all that sort of thing, if it's used for the family, regardless of where the money came from to buy it, is going to make it a family asset. Now, there are some things that the agreement says are not family assets. They're non-family assets. And one of the things, by implication, I don't believe that it's really clear in the agreement, but it would be the actual earned income of Mr. Moore. That by the terms of the agreement, I think by clear implication, was to be his separate property. But it said that if it was used for family purposes or to the extent that it was used to buy things that became quote-unquote family assets, that then that what would have been separate income, separate assets, non-family assets, became family assets.
Mr. McGuane, pardon me for interrupting
sure.
you, but I want to ask a question specifically about this stock, okay?
Sure.
When I read the agreement, I see in paragraph 3, subsection 1, that husband and wife will each retain sole ownership, control, and enjoyment of all of his or her property, except vehicles which he or she owns at the time of their marriage, free from any claim whatsoever by the other. Now, whether or not we characterize the property as a family asset or marital property, doesn't this language indicate, particularly free from any claim whatsoever by the other, that if they owned it separately beforehand, that it would not be divided as a marital asset?
I would interpret that to mean not exactly what Your Honor says, that if there's a separate asset, but it ends up being used, for example, if it was inherited money or if it was a PCL stock that Mr. Moore owned before, and he used that money, used that asset to buy a residence for the family, that would convert it to a family asset, irrespective of this language.
Let's start with hypothetical one. Let's say he inherited stock before the marriage, and nothing was ever done with that stock. And at the time of the marriage, the stock still existed. Would that be separate property?
I would think that would be separate property, yes.
So your argument is, in depending on the way it's used, it may or may not become a family asset. For example, you're saying if dividends were used to buy a family home, then it would be a family asset and thus divisible as such, right?
Correct. Yes.
Thank you.
And then there's another provision in the agreement that says that if Mrs. Moore stays at home to take care of the children of the family, that any assets acquired with Mr. Moore's earnings, which otherwise would be his separate property under the agreement, to the extent that they were used to purchase assets, even if they were in his separate name, that she would be entitled to 50% of those in the event of a divorce.
Let me pursue the stock, if I could, with a couple of hopefully clear and specific questions. Do you agree with your opponent's characterization that the stock was liquidated and the proceeds of that liquidation went through this joint account for a period of a day or two, and that is the $260,000 we're talking about?
I think it's only part of that, Your Honor. I'm not totally clear, to be honest with you. When I heard the court's questions to counsel in the opening component of her argument, I went back and looked at the transcript, which is Appendix 3 to my brief, on page 8 of that transcript of just the findings and order, and there's a considerable discussion by the court about the PCL stock, and the court said this is a quote now, the court finds that although there is significant testimony and credible testimony from both parties that the initial PCL stock was purchased by the respondent with funds from his separate asset, the court finds that it is the status of his employment that allowed him to obtain the benefit. And then it goes on to essentially tie all that to employment and in effect use that as a way to make this all family assets.
But isn't that a conclusion of law that we could we could review de novo rather than a conclusion of fact? Because I mean, it seems to me what you're saying is, and I'm not asking you to concede any factual disputes, but I mean, if he buys the stock with his inheritance, and you stop there, it'd still be his property, right?
Correct.
Okay. And what the court seems to be saying is, because he could only buy the stock as an employee of the company, therefore it became a perquisite of his employment, no matter where the money came from.
Right.
That sounds to me like a legal conclusion, not something that is fact-based on which the evidence was disputed.
Well, I think that piece of it is a legal conclusion, but I think it's mixed in with facts, so you end up with a mixed question then, because of the fact that it was not simply a matter of this particular block of stock being bought with this particular block of money. From my understanding, from reading the transcript of the court's findings and the record, that there were a number of pieces that were all mixed together here, which is what particularly makes this so complex.
Well, if that's true, and that kind of was my reaction too, shouldn't the trial court then have apportioned the stock to the extent that the accountant's testimony showed that some of it was traceable back to the inheritance, and maybe some of it was traceable to the bonuses? And I realize that you know, the husband disputes that, but I mean, don't we either have to apportion it that way or accept the trial court's conclusion that it became marital because the proceeds of the ultimate liquidation were washed through the joint account?
Well, I think ideally the court should have done the proportion, but that depends on, well, the ability to do that depends on what the evidence was, and I think the conclusion that one must reach from looking at the findings and conclusions of the court, that Judge Arkin did the best she could in trying to sort all this out. And after listening to the conflicting testimony by the parties and the conflicting testimony by Mr. Vincent and Mr. Campbell, the accountants, she, as I said, did the best she could to come to an appropriate conclusion here.
I appreciate you didn't try the case, so this may be details beyond your knowledge, but did the wife's expert concede that any portion of that stock had been bought with separate funds, and if so, to what extent?
I can't honestly.
Okay, that's fair. Go on then, please.
Yeah, okay.
Counsel, how do you reconcile Judge Arkin treating the inheritance money of the wife one way and treating the PCL money a different way when they both pass through a joint account?
I'm not in a position to answer that question very well either, if at all. Probably ideally they should have been treated consistently, but honestly, I'm not familiar enough with the details of the record to be able to answer that question any better. I'm sorry.
Well, related question, and again, this may be an unfair detail point. Was husband's testimony that washing the money through this account for a day or two was simply a matter of convenience and not intent dispute?
I cannot answer that question.
Okay.
What I keep coming back to every time I think about this particular point is the provision in the marital agreement that talks about, let me see if I can spot it real quickly here, that talks about property once being converted to joint money.
I think you're looking for paragraph 3, double small I. It's on the pages of the agreement aren't numbered, unfortunately.
Right.
Probably on page 3.
Double I is what I was looking for. Is that what you were saying?
Yes, sir.
It says property at any time owned jointly by both spouses or recorded or acquired in their joint names. I think
but the time goes on to say unless, you know, otherwise expressly agreed.
Right. And I don't know that there was any express agreement. I think that was this particular language of the agreement was part of what Judge Arkin relied on, as I recall from the record, in coming to the conclusion that the running the money through this joint account essentially converted it to joint property.
Counsel, let me back up. For about the last half hour, we've been discussing various interpretations of this prenup agreement. And it would be the role of the court to interpret a prenup agreement de novo, too, as I understand it.
Agree.
So why do we have to turn to the statute at all if we have an agreement that both sides agree is valid?
Well, because the agreement does not cover all the different components of this case. The agreement defines what are family assets, and I think to the fullest extent the court could have done so, it was obligated to enforce the agreement. But as to any of the other pieces that were not covered by the agreement, then I think Colorado law would kick in, and that's why we have this mixture of interpreting the agreement to the extent that you can, and Colorado law on the other to fill in all the blanks.
What was not covered by the agreement that we wouldn't be able to, by looking at the agreement, decide where an asset went, for instance?
Well, let's see. I guess the first question is to determine whether the term family assets covers everything that's in the marital estate, and I believe that it actually did cover almost everything except the debt issue that was discussed in your exchange with counsel in her opening argument, because I think that clearly debts are not covered by the agreement, at least clearly to me. So that's one area which goes to the $76,000 that it's being argued should somehow have been refunded to Mr. Moore. There are other pieces in there, but I think the long and the short of it is that this was an extremely challenging case for Judge Arkin, and sure, we could she'd probably be the first one to say that this was not a perfect order, that she did the best she could. I can tell you on behalf of the appellee that she did not totally like every aspect of the order, but I would respectfully submit that the time has come to find a way to put an end to this litigation and allow the parties to get on with their lives, that the mistakes that might have been made in one way or another were not so great as to call for sending this case back and many, many, many thousands of dollars and more emotional and financial expense just to try to fix those. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands.